Chapter 20. Logic versus Small Talk. I'm a very logical guy. Psychologists say that's an Aspergian trait. This can lead to trouble in common social situations because ordinary conversation doesn't always proceed logically. In an effort to improve my own interpersonal skills, I've studied computer programs that engage in conversation with people. The best programs follow logical pathways to arrive at suitable responses. The results, however, don't always sound natural, and I am not sure that I do much better than the machines. For example, last week my friend Lori said, "One of my girlfriends is having an affair, and the guy rides a motorcycle just like yours." Lori's statement posed a problem. Unlike most interactions, ours had not started with a question. Should I respond with an opinion about the statement? Or should I ask a question myself? I considered what I had just heard. Lori has a girlfriend. Yes, Lori has lots of girlfriends. Which one is she talking about? The girlfriend's having an affair. Why tell me? Do I know her? Do I know the guy? Is this a convoluted way of suggesting that I should have an affair since I have a motorcycle? The boyfriend has a motorcycle. Well, that narrows it down. Most potential boyfriends have cars, not bikes. So this boyfriend is one of the 5% as opposed to the 95% of the motoring public. Do I know him? The motorcycle is just like mine. How much does Lori know about bikes? Does she mean he rides an Electra Glide Classic? Or does she just mean his motorcycle is black? I was not able to deduce a suitable response to her statements. What did she mean by them? There was no logical connection between Lori's sentences. I stared at the floor and pondered my next move. I knew I had to think fast. If I think too long, people say, "Did you hear me?" or "Are you paying attention?" I knew she wanted a relevant response, something connected to what she had just said, more than just, "Oh." I also knew from experience and observation that a statement like, "I went to Newport to see the jazz festival last weekend," would not be an appropriate answer. It occurred to me that what I needed to do was to keep gathering information until I could frame an intelligent conversation. The successful conversational computer programs did that. So I asked a question. "Which girlfriend is that?" Lori looked surprised. "Why would you want to know that?" she said. I hadn't expected a challenge. She sounded suspicious. I wiggled my ears and wondered a little at that. The fact that she had responded that way told me she had been expecting some other response. What did she expect me to say? Perhaps I should have answered with a made-up statement that echoed hers. I could have said, "My friend Spike is having an affair, too. And the girl he's involved with has a motorcycle like mine, too." But it would have been nonsense. And I never utter nonsense replies unless I'm playing a prank. I can't help thinking there must have been some purpose to Lori's original statement, and a statement with a purpose calls for a meaningful response. Perhaps I should have just played dumb. I have observed that a drawled, "Wow," accompanied by a smile can be an acceptable response to almost anything. But I can't smile on command, and I can't bring myself to act like a moron. Still, a "wow" would probably not have disturbed Lori. If I say, "One of the guys at work got into a car accident today," I am prepared for you to say, "Who was in the wreck?" If the identity of the person were a secret, why would I bring it up in the first place? I could have focused on the motorcycle part of Lori's statement. If so, I'd have said, "What kind of bike does he ride?" Once again, I'd expect some kind of answer other than, "It's none of your business." When I asked Lori why she was suspicious, she had a couple of questions for me. "Why do you need to know? Nothing good could come of me telling you. What if it got back to her husband?" I figured out what I should have said by chance, observing two women talking at a restaurant a short while later. "Jenny in accounting is having an affair, and the guy drives a Corvette." The opening line was strikingly similar, so I paid attention. How cool is that? Is he married? Listening to that exchange, it was obvious that this was the correct response. When I heard them talk, I suddenly understood that Lori's statement had been meant to entertain or impress me, and that my response should have been an expression of admiration or excitement. However, that never occurred to me at the time. It's clear to me that regular people have conversational capabilities far beyond mine, and their responses often have nothing at all to do with logic. I suspect normal people are hardwired to develop the ability to read social cues in a way that I am not. Small talk, or any kind of talk that goes beyond a simple exchange of information, has always been a challenge for me. When I was young, I learned that people would not like it when I uttered the first thought that entered my mind when they approached. Since making that discovery, I have slowly taught myself how to succeed at conversation, most of the time. I have learned to begin conversations with a question like, "How are you?" I have learned a range of questions that are socially acceptable. But my inventory of questions is limited, and it seems other people are a lot more flexible. I now know that my logically derived responses to statements like Lori's sometimes come off as intrusive or prying. That makes no sense at all to me. I framed the first relevant question that came to mind after hearing her speak. My response was friendly. So why was she disturbed? After all, she brought the whole thing up. In my opinion, people should not make statements unless they're prepared to respond to questions about the words they utter. But the world doesn't always work that way. Thinking about conversations like the one I had with Lori makes me mad. People approach me uninvited and make unsolicited statements. When they don't get the response they expect, they become indignant. If I offer no response at all, they become indignant at that. So there is no way for me to win. Given that line of reasoning, why talk to people at all? Well, many autistic people don't. Possibly for that very reason. But for some reason, I want the Loris of the world to like me, to not think I am weird. I can be eccentric, but I don't want to be weird. So I persist. I try to say the things a normal person would say. Normal people seem to learn certain stock questions and utter them to fill a conversational void. For example, when meeting someone they have not seen in a while, they say things like, "How's your wife? How's your son? You're looking good. Did you lose weight?" Normal people will emit statements like this in the absence of any provocation or any visual indication that there may have been a change in the wife or son or the weight. Some people I've observed appear to have many dozens of these stock questions at their command, and I have never been able to figure out how they choose a particular phrase for emission at any given moment. When someone walks up to you, his appearance does not normally suggest a change in the status of his wife or son, and most people's appearance does not change enough from week to week, or even month to month, to provide a logical basis for the question about weight. Yet people say those things, and the recipients of the words smile and answer with similar platitudes, such as, "The wife is fine. The kid's up for parole next January. I had my stomach stapled and lost 50 pounds. And then, surprisingly, they often say, "Thanks for asking." How normal people know which of these questions to ask is a mystery to me. Do they have better memory than me, or is it just luck? It must be social conditioning, something that I am completely lacking. I don't ask about the wife, because when my friend walks up to me, I'm interested in talking to him, and the condition or status of his wife does not enter my mind. More specifically, his appearance does not give me reason to wonder about his wife's well-being. If he's a good friend, I assume, probably correctly, that any major change in his wife or son's status would precipitate some kind of notification to me and his other friends. So why ask? As to the weight, if he looks bigger, I'd say, "You seem fatter than the last time I saw you." I've learned by life experience that people get fatter for any number of reasons, most of which are benign. I am aware that people may not like having their deficiencies, increased bulk, for instance, pointed out. But my mouth may spit out, "You look fatter," before my brain concludes, "It would be rude to say he looks fatter." Losing weight is another matter. If someone looks a lot thinner, I might say, "You look a lot thinner. Are you sick?" I know people go on diets, but people my age are just as likely to be thinner because there's something wrong with them. Maybe they have cancer or something even worse. So if they look a lot thinner, I might just cut to the chase and ask. I've heard questions like, "How's your son?" described as icebreakers. I don't think to say those things unless I have consciously prepared to engage in conversation prior to approaching someone. I am tongue-tied when approaching people unless they speak to me first. If I do speak up, I often say something that's taken as rude or surprising, especially when I've told people something true that they don't want to hear. That's why I learned some years ago to utter a noncommittal "woof" if I need to begin a conversation or fill a silence. People hear that and are not sure what to say, but they don't usually perceive a "woof" as rude. I try to work with whatever response I get. In the past, when people criticized me for asking unexpected questions, I felt ashamed. Now I realize that normal people are acting in a superficial and often false manner. So rather than let them make me feel bad, I express my annoyance. It's my way of trying to strike a blow for logic and rationality. My conversational difficulties highlight a problem Aspergians face every day. A person with an obvious disability, for example, someone in a wheelchair, is treated compassionately because his handicap is obvious. No one turns to a guy in a wheelchair and says, "Quick, let's run across the street." And when he can't run across the street, no one says, "What's his problem?" They offer to help him across the street. With me, though, there is no external sign that I am conversationally handicapped. So folks hear some conversational misstep and say, "What an arrogant jerk." I look forward to the day when my handicap will afford me the same respect accorded to a guy in a wheelchair. And if the respect comes with a preferred parking space, I won't turn it down. Woof! Chapter 21. Being Young Executives. When we started work at Milton Bradley, we were young and enthusiastic. My co-conspirator, Bob, and I were convinced that our toys would change the world. Some nights, we worked till midnight as we raced to get the latest electronic gadget ready for production. And in this line of work, there was no need for any special skill making small talk. We were geeks before the age of personal computers. We were there to create new things and solve problems, not impress anyone with our suave social skills. Still, it would have helped to know a little more about gaming the system in a big company. As it turned out, we had our first experience with corporate politics shortly after starting work. Dark Tower was one of our hot new games for the 1981 season. It was an electronic version of an older role-playing fantasy game. The centerpiece was a tower that rotated and stopped in front of each player. The trouble was, it was stopping in the wrong places. And as an engineer in the development group for Dark Tower, it was Bob's problem. He scratched his head and pondered and guessed and experimented as he tried to figure out what to do. Now that I was on the inside, watching him, I was amazed to discover the technical sophistication in a $39 electronic game. In many ways, such games were more sophisticated than the devices I'd worked with in the music business, some of which cost 1,000 times more. It seemed like a simple thing. You'd turn the motor on, and it would move. You'd turn the power off, and it would stop, right? Unfortunately, it wasn't that simple. Inertia caused the motor to keep moving for a little while before it stopped, just as a car rolls some distance after the engine stalls. The trouble was, there was no predicting exactly how far it would move. "This would be easy if we had a $50 parts budget," Bob mused. "Yeah," I said, "but it's a whole nother matter to figure out how to do it for 25 cents. And that was the crux of the problem. In the toy business, everything had to be done for pennies, And it took all our technical skill to devise solutions that worked with the fewest possible parts or the simplest possible assemblies. When we succeeded, we felt a certain pride in creating elegant and workable designs. But it didn't always work out. After a month of 60-hour work weeks, Bob had the answer. "A clamping circuit," he told me. "We'll use the transistors to clamp the motor so it stops as soon as we cut the power." "That's just like the dynamic brakes on a locomotive," I said. I loved it. Who would ever guess that the same principles that held a freight train back on steep hills would stop the Dark Tower? Bob's idea worked. The tower stopped where it was supposed to. The game was ready to sell. But a month later, Bob got a rude shock. "Did you hear what happened?" he fumed. "Alan took credit for my design, and they gave him an award. He stole my idea." There wasn't much I could say. Our youthful exuberance was starting to wear off as our creative desires ran up against corporate politics. Meanwhile, my group was racing to introduce the first talking game, and I had been given the task of designing a system to collect speech and turn it into digital data. I designed the analog parts of the system, and Klaus did the digital work. We used one of the first microcomputers, an MSI 8080, to collect and store the data. It was a Rube Goldberg kind of contraption, with hundreds of parts tied together with wire wrap and cables spread across a bunch of breadboards on a workbench in my lab. And as soon as it was built and tested, we put it right to work. I sat in front of a computer monitor with my finger on a keyboard. Operation was simple. G meant go. The system would record whatever it heard for the next 6 seconds. S meant save. We began collecting and digitizing speech. "Hey, hey, hey, pick your play." One at a time, the entire staff passed through the lab, reading and recording the mindless phrases that would become our new game's vocabulary. "You pick three," and the classic, "It's my turn." All the engineers and techs had a chance to try out as the voice of tomorrow's toy. In the end, though, the voice the public heard was that of Mike Myers, one of the VPs. It may have sounded idiotic, but I was proud of my design, and no one else stole the credit for my little part. The speech guys took the data my device collected and turned it into a tiny stream of bits that would feed our new talking integrated circuit. We had reduced the complexity of speech into a few crumbs, like the food left behind in my shirt pocket. Amazingly, it still sounded pretty good. Today, it seems like every kid you see has a Game Boy or some similar electronic game. But in the late 1970s, there was no such thing. However, that was about to change. Not long after I started, we came out with the first handheld video game with changeable cartridges. They called it Microvision. Microvision consisted of a console with snap-on game cartridges. All of a sudden, millions of kids had to have Microvision and the games that went with it: Blockbuster, Pinball, Bowling, Connect Four, and all the others. After its first Christmas, we could see that Microvision was going to be the next hot toy. Milton Bradley's Simon had been the hot game the year before, and it looked like we had another winner this season. The holidays had passed, and it still sold as fast as we could make it. But in the early fall, news started filtering up from the plant. "Hey, did you hear about Microvision?" said Brad, one of the engineers who had worked on its release. "They're getting tons of dead ones returned. There was a crazed mom at the Federal Square plant yesterday making a scene over her kid's broken Microvision. And now they're having trouble on the assembly line, too. Lots of defective units." Brad didn't sound too concerned. After all, we were R&D, and that was a production matter. They were very concerned in the factory. Just as they were ramping up production for Christmas, the defect rate on the production line skyrocketed. Defects went from 5% to 60% in a matter of weeks. Management was panicked. There were probably a million Microvision consoles on order, with no way to fill the orders. It was a toy maker's worst nightmare. The company had never experienced anything like that in its 100-year history. After all, Puzzles and chess sets never broke down. Electronic toys were a new concept at Milton Bradley. The old-timers in the company thought longingly of the days when new product meant making blue checkers instead of the traditional red. The first line of defense was our quality assurance and manufacturing engineering groups. But both departments were stumped. Management became desperate. There was desk pounding and foot stomping in the executive suite, until finally they decided to turn to the weirdos in R&D. The R&D boss was accordingly summoned, and he said, "I have just the guy for you. He's an analog engineer. He'll have a fresh perspective on the situation." Just like that, I had a new job assignment. I started reading books on manufacturing. Then I started in on quality. I read till 1 a.m. some nights, and I asked questions. What's changed in the manufacturing process? Nothing. How about testing or shipping? No change there either. Are the parts different? Did we get a bad batch? Nope. We bought 250,000 parts kits back in the spring, and we're still using that stock. Bummer. Back in the lab, I talked things over with my friend Bob, who worked in product development. We had started out wearing ties to work and sport jackets. Supposedly, the engineers wore ties and the technicians didn't. We were expected to dress and act like young executives, though we had little concept of what that meant. Or rather, our concept differed sharply from what our bosses thought it meant. We were there to design circuits, but more than that, we were there for fun. We were there to chase the girls in product testing and the art department. Our bosses, on the other hand, were there to work. Or more precisely, they were there to make us work. That was the definition of management, getting others to do your work for you. And we were the others. This microvision problem had the sound of serious work. I didn't like it. Maybe someone's sabotaging microvision. Think that's possible? Bob was skeptical. He spent a lot more time in the plants than me, and he said the factory seemed pretty peaceful. I don't ever see fights or blood on the floor when I go down there anymore. I don't think anyone's destroying them on purpose. I pondered his words. Any more? Did he mean there was once blood on the floor in the factory? I guessed he did. That's why I didn't go there. I was getting a little worried. By now, hundreds of dead microvision consoles were coming off the production line every day, and management had progressed from panic to outright frenzy. But I knew I could figure it out. At least, I hoped I could. And if I couldn't, well, there were always other employers. I needed help. I called Bob again. He suggested we have a meeting to talk things over. We agreed to get together a few hours later to discuss the situation. At the appointed time, I stood waiting for Bob, tapping my watch and pacing back and forth. I had driven quickly to get to the meeting on time, but he was nowhere to be found. I paced faster. I felt like the weight of the whole world was on my shoulders. We didn't have cell phones in those days, so there was nothing I could do but wait. I became irritated. If I was left waiting at a senior management meeting, I could at least go hang around at the bar and get a drink, or maybe a snack. Here, there was nothing but a parking lot. I had only been in a real job for a little over a year, but I was already getting a sense of corporate life. It wasn't what I had imagined, looking in from the outside. Then I saw him. At least, I thought it was him. I couldn't tell for sure. The boat was still a mile away, but it was approaching fast. As it got closer, I recognized Bob's Sea Ray, and within a few moments I could see Bob. I walked down the dock and jumped aboard as he pulled in close. "Sorry I was late," he said, handing me a drink. "I had to get gas, and there was a line at Pizzarama." Bob backed away from the floating dock, swung the boat around, and headed into the river. I took a slice of pepperoni pizza and ate while watching our wake roll out behind us. As Bob drove, I contemplated the future of microvision. Back in the factory, 120 workers were building microvision as fast as they could. Until we found an answer, 6 out of every 10 machines were headed for the scrap heap. But there were no scrap microvision boxes out here on the river. It was a fine fall day. The leaves were just starting to turn. This was the right place to contemplate our company's problems. "So what do you make of it?" I asked Bob. "Drinks are in the cooler," was his reply. Bob had also worked on another of the company's products, Big Track. Big Track was a programmable tank that crawled around on the floor and made noises. We in engineering were always seeking to expand our lowly tank's horizons. "You know, Bob, I was thinking, we could put a stun gun on the arm of that Big Track and make a serious ankle biter. Then it could defend itself. It'd be a rude shock for a smart-ass kid that kicked a Big Track." Bob smiled at the thought of some 9-year-old monster knocked flat after going for our tank with a hammer. We were ahead of our time with that idea. As I write this story, more than 25 years have passed, and today's toys still lack defensive capabilities, and kids still destroy them, much to the distress of their designers. But Bob and I thought of it way back then. In a subsequent meeting, management declined to add our enhancements to the popular tank. As young executives, we had watched the big bosses conducting the truly important business of the company on the golf course. We knew that unimportant meetings took place in conference rooms. More important meetings took place in the boardroom. But the really important meetings, the ones that took all day and sometimes several days, took place at the country club. Bob and I had not yet been admitted to that inner sanctum, but we had it in our sights. We knew that we were following the example of our leaders, solving the tough problems for our factory out on the water. "Do you think there's a problem with the chip design?" Bob wondered. We were both grasping at straws. "I really don't know," I said. "How about a power supply problem?" Bob wondered. Perhaps the spray of water from a passing boat gave us the answer. I'll never know where or how it arrived. But that was what they paid us for. Design ideas that contained less than 5 parts, cost less than 10 cents, and saved the world by lunchtime. Once I saw the answer, it seemed obvious. As summer turned to fall, the air became drier. Lower humidity meant more static electricity. The same phenomenon that makes you crackle and spark when you pull on a sweater was killing the microvision units. "Static!" I blurted out to Bob. "Huh? That's what's killing the microvision. Static!" "Static!" He repeated the word several times, savoring it. "Yeah, maybe you're right." My brain went into high gear as I considered how to prove my hypothesis that static was killing microvision. And assuming I was right, what would we do about it? Millions of dollars in faulty product was at stake, along with people's jobs. This was not some abstract R&D problem. This was production. And production was a rougher, tougher world. I had heard stories about how they motivated engineers down there when things got tough. Line up 3 and shoot 2. The remaining 1 would work faster. The whole concept of management was different down there. We had read books about manufacturing, labor relations, and the history of American industries, like coal mining and steelmaking. We weren't sure how similar our factory was to a turn-of-the-century steel mill. And we didn't want to find out. In our departments, managers motivated us with encouragement and inspiration. They smiled and had good manners. In the mill, manners and encouraging words were like a foreign language. Successful managers had bruised knuckles. Some had brass knuckles. The bosses had worn and dented baseball bats leaned up against the insides of their doors. The pizza was gone, but we had a plan. We returned to the dock as we pondered the next step. Would a better ground help? I had some adhesive-backed copper foil that I was using on another project. Perhaps I could use the foil to dissipate the static charge harmlessly. I stuck a piece to the front of a microvision console. I attached the foil to the ground trace on the circuit board. Then I put a similar piece of foil on the cartridge door and attached it to the cartridge's ground plane. It worked. Whenever you plug the cartridge into the console, the foil pieces touched before anything else, and the static charge was dissipated harmlessly. It was time to test the idea on some real games. I requested a box of new games, fresh from the production floor. They arrived moments later, reaffirming the importance management placed on our work. I pulled my sweater off and on, and I shuffled across the floor in rubber-soled shoes. When I touched the light switch, a spark snapped from my finger to the wall. Satisfied with my static charge, I pulled the sweater off and on a few more times, then picked up an unmodified microvision. It was dead in my hand. I then picked up my modified game, and it still worked. I did this time and again until I had filled the trash can with microvision consoles. Not one of my modified units failed. I was elated. I knew then I would not be shot. I had found the answer. In the end, it was such a simple thing. Paper clips are simple, too. Some of the finest engineering creations are, in fact, the simplest. At times, we are truly masters of the obvious. From that moment on, the microvision war was won. All the rest was just mopping up. I added some circuitry to toughen the circuits against static. The production engineers got anti-static materials to line the assembly areas. And the factory was fitted with a system that sprayed a fine mist of water into the air above the workstations to keep static from forming in the first place. Bob and I had a better source of water mist, the Connecticut River. We continued to meet there, on that project and others to follow. I was hard at work on Milton, the next electronic marvel, and Bob was back to Super Simon. Milton was to be the world's first talking electronic game. Toys had spoken for years without electronics, using mechanical gramophone technology like the trumpet horn record players of the 1900s. Dolls like Chatty Cathy would utter a phrase when a child pulled a string. But an interactive talking game would be a first. As it turned out, Milton did talk. Unfortunately, game buyers didn't seem to want to listen, and Milton vanished without a trace a year later. I'm sure my solution to microvision static problems saved the company hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe more. But like Bob's experience with Dark Tower, the award never made it to my desk, and the bonus didn't reach my bank account. The buck stopped a bit higher up the food chain. We never did achieve that coveted country club membership either. A decade later, Bob achieved renown as the designer and co-inventor of Mattel's Diva Stars and Cabbage Patch Kids Kick and Splash and Milton Bradley's Whack-A-Mole electronic games. And that fall, I was offered a new job as director of R&D for a manufacturer of fire alarms and time clocks. I tramped off to climb the corporate ladder, leaving Bob in his world of toys. The trouble was, the higher I advanced in the corporate world, the more I had to rely on my people skills, and the less my technical skills and creativity mattered. For someone like me, that was a formula for disaster. I moved on to my new job at Simplex in Gardner, about an hour's drive away. At Simplex, I wore a suit to work. I had an office with a door and my own secretary to guard it. And after a year, I managed a staff of 20 people. But it proved to be a mistake. I wasn't happy. I felt I was surrounded by mediocrity, both in my own work and in my choice of employment. I had gone from designing toys, a fun thing, to overseeing the design of time clocks to keep track of America's factory workers. Not a fun thing. Unfortunately, there was no going back. Things had gone bad at Milton Bradley Electronics shortly after I left. The company wrote off a $30 million investment in computer games, and Bob and most of my friends lost their jobs. A short while later, the company was sold. I was beginning to realize that executive job did not equal job security. In the midst of my struggles to become part of corporate America, I got married. Little Bear and I tied the knot in the summer of 1982. I was 25 years old. We were happy at first, But as things worsened at work, I brought my problems home. I was upset about work, and Little Bear was wrapped up in the world of the Science Fiction Society, a club at the university. She was once again a college student after having taken the previous few years off. After seeing Bob lose his job, I was laid off from Simplex in 1984. They, too, were experiencing financial troubles. It was a scary time for Little Bear and me, since I was the sole breadwinner while she was in school. And to make things worse, while I was out of work, her brother Paul died in a car crash. With the stress of all those things, we began to grow apart. It was not a happy time for us. Luckily, I found a new job fairly quickly. I started work at Isoreg, a small company that manufactured power transformers. Unfortunately, I now had a 1.5-hour commute. Life as an executive was not turning out the way they portrayed it on TV. By 1988, I had moved through two more jobs, and I had swallowed all I could take of the corporate world. I had come to accept what my annual performance reviews said. I was not a team player. I had trouble communicating with people. I was inconsiderate. I was rude. I was smart and creative, yes, but I was a misfit. I was thoroughly sick of all the criticism. I was sick of life. Literally. I had come down with asthma, and attacks were sending me to the emergency room every few months. I hated to get up and face another day at work. I knew what I needed to do. I needed to stop forcing myself to fit into something I could never be a part of. A big company. A group. A team. When I was 5, I had wanted more than anything to be part of the team. When I was a little older, I had tried out for Little League, but no one had picked me. I never tried out for a team after that. Maybe those rejections were still with me 20 years later. "You need to be part of the team," I heard over and over. What, be one more idiot in a suit? Not me. "You need to be a little more diplomatic when you point out problems in other people's designs." "Well, the design is just junk. It will never work. I did better work than that when I was 15. "You may think your circuit is the greatest thing ever, but it's not the direction we want to go in." "So you want to use the other group's design, the one that costs twice as much and is half as efficient, just because Dan sucks up to you in meetings and doesn't call you a jerk the way I do. Do I have that right?" It took me 4 jobs and 10 years to realize the folly of my efforts. And by the way, years later, in 1998, I was admitted to the country club. But I had no need for it by then. I wasn't a part of management anymore. And I couldn't play golf. Chapter 22. Becoming Normal. I thought a lot about how I made the transition from being an Aspergian misfit to seeming almost normal. It's been a gradual process. I believe there is a continuum from autism to Asperger's to normal. At one extreme, you have children who are turned completely inward from birth. They go through life thinking their own thoughts, and parents and other outsiders can barely connect with them at all. At the other end of the spectrum, you have kids who are turned completely outward. They have scarcely any ability to be introspective or to perform difficult mental calculations. People like that might not make good engineers, but they often go far in life because interpersonal skill is one of the most important predictors of success. And in the middle, you have people like me, some more functional, some less. We can focus our minds inward, and we also have some ability to relate to people and the outside world. Some Aspergians can focus their minds extremely sharply, and those of us who cultivate this gift are sometimes called savants. Being a savant is a mixed blessing, because that laser-like focus often comes at a cost. Very limited abilities in non-savant areas. I don't think I'm a savant, just a highly intelligent Aspergian. But I suspect I was on the edge of becoming a savant when I was a small child. and my later ability to visualize mathematical functions and the operation of circuits was savant-like. Until recently, there were no widely available sources of knowledge about how savants or Aspergians actually think or see things. But recent books and studies have started to shed light on this. When I read Daniel Tammet's book, Born on a Blue Day, I was amazed by the similarities between thought processes he describes and my own thinking. I've seen similar parallels between my thought process and Temple Grandin's descriptions of thinking in pictures. As more first-hand accounts of lives like ours emerge, I sense we are on the brink of many exciting discoveries about autism and Asperger's. When we are young, our brains are constantly developing, making new connections, and changing the way we think. As I recall my own development, I can see how I went through periods where my ability to focus inward and do complex calculations in my mind developed rapidly. When that happened, my ability to solve complex technical or mathematical problems increased, but I withdrew from other people. Later, there were periods where my ability to turn toward other people and the world increased by leaps and bounds. At those times, my intense powers of focused reasoning seemed to diminish. I believe that some kids who are in the middle to more high-functioning range of the autism continuum, like me, do not receive the proper stimulation and end up turning inward to such an extent that they can't function in society, even though they may be incredibly brilliant in some narrowly defined field, like abstract mathematics. Scientists have studied brain plasticity, the ability of the brain to reorganize neural pathways based on new experiences. It appears that different types of plasticity are dominant at different ages. Looking back on my childhood, I think the ages of 4 to 7 were critical for my social development. That was when I cried and hurt because I could not make friends. At those times, I could have withdrawn further from people so that I would not get hurt, but I didn't. Fortunately, I had enough satisfactory exchanges with intelligent grown-ups, my family and their friends at college, to keep me wanting to interact. I can easily imagine a child who did not have any satisfying exchanges withdrawing from people entirely, and a kid who withdrew at age 5 might be very hard to coax out later. I also believe considerable rewiring took place in my own brain in my 30s and even later. I believe this because I can compare my thought process today to my processes as expressed in writing and circuit designs from 25 years ago. Papers I wrote back then are flat and devoid of inflection or emotion. I didn't write about my feelings because I didn't understand them. Today, my greater insight into my emotional life has allowed me to express it, both verbally and on paper. But there was a trade-off for that increased emotional intelligence. I look at circuits I designed 20 years ago, and it's as if someone else did them. Some of my designs were true masterpieces of economy and functionality. Many people told me they were expressions of a creative genius. And today, I don't understand them at all. When I look at those old drawings, I am reminded of a book I read as a teenager, Flowers for Algernon. Scientists took a retarded janitor and made him a genius, but it didn't last. His brilliance faded away before his eyes. That's how I feel sometimes, looking back at the creative engineering I've done. Those designs were the fruit of a part of my mind that is no longer with me. I will never invent circuits like that again. I may conceive of something like Ace Frehley's light guitar, but someone else will have to design it. My story isn't sad, though, because my mind didn't fade or die. It just rewired itself. I'm sure my mind has the same power it always did, but in a more broadly focused configuration. No one would have looked at me 30 years ago and foreseen that I'd have the social skills I have today, or the ability to express the emotions, thoughts, and feelings you read in this book. I would never have predicted it either. It's been a good trade. Creative genius never helped me make friends, and it certainly didn't make me happy. My life today is immeasurably happier, richer, and fuller as a result of my brain's continuing development. I suspect that grown-ups drew me out enough as a child to keep me engaged and on a path that led to being functional in society. Adults were able to deal with my conversational limitations better than children. They could follow my disconnected responses, and they were more likely to show interest in anything I said, no matter how bizarre. Had I not been drawn out by interested grown-ups, I might well have drifted farther into the world of autism. I might have ceased to communicate. Even at 16 years of age, it would have been easy for me to retreat from dealing with humans and move into the world within my own mind. Looking back, I can see a path that might have led somewhere far away, perhaps to autism, perhaps to the place where the savants who can multiply 10-digit numbers in their minds live. After all, I got along well with my circuits, and they never ridiculed me. They presented me with tough problems to solve, but they were never mean. Around the time I dropped out of school, it was almost as though I stood in front of door number one and door number two, as perplexed as any game show contestant, and with much more at stake, and was forced to make a choice. My crazy family situation and my need to run away from home and join the working world in order to survive kept me from making that choice. So I chose door number one, and in doing so, moved farther away from the world of machines and circuits, a comfortable world of muted colors, soft light, and mechanical perfection, and closer to the anxiety-filled, bright, and disorderly world of people. As I consider that choice 30 years later, I think the kids who choose door number two may not end up able to function in society. As a functional Aspergian adult, one thing troubles me deeply about those kids who end up behind the second door. Many descriptions of autism and Asperger's describe people like me as not wanting contact with others or preferring to play alone. I can't speak for other kids, but I'd like to be very clear about my own feelings. I did not ever want to be alone. And all those child psychologists who said, "John prefers to play by himself," were dead wrong. I played by myself because I was a failure at playing with others. I was alone as a result of my own limitations, and being alone was one of the bitterest disappointments of my young life. The sting of those early failures followed me long into adulthood, even after I learned about Asperger's. As a young adult, I was lucky to discover and join the world of musicians and soundmen and special effects people. People in those lines of work expect to deal with eccentric people. I was smart, I was capable, and I was creative, and for them, that was good enough. In some ways, it was a mistake for me to have left that world, because I was accepted and made to feel welcome there, something I seldom felt in corporate life. But I could not afford to keep moving ahead with my work in electronics with my non-existent resources. I had to get a job. In the corporate world, I had started out as an engineer, making $25,000 a year. Back in the 1970s, that was pretty good money. As I moved up, the pay increased. Staff engineer, manager of advanced development, assistant director of planning, director of engineering, and finally, general manager of power systems. After 10 years, I was making $100,000 a year. I was the envy of all the people below me in the food chain, but it was a vicious trap. In the beginning, I created circuit designs. That was something I loved to do and did well. 10 years later, my job was managing people and projects. I enjoyed the status and respect, but I wasn't good at management, and I didn't like it. The problem was that if I wanted to be an engineer, I'd be looking at a 50% cut in pay and a job in some other company. The message was clear. Managers are more valuable than engineers. That made me mad. I wasn't going to consider going down the ladder and down the pay scale just to be creative. I wanted it all: good pay, independence, and creativity. "You should really be working on your own," I was told by my bosses. Was that a precursor to "you're fired"? I had already been laid off, rejected twice. In 1983, I went from a seemingly secure $60,000 salary to a $197 weekly unemployment check. And I had to stand in line for an hour and fill out two forms to get even that. I resolved in 1983 that I would never again collect unemployment. I realized the comments were right. I was not a team player, so I needed to work on my own. But what could I do that might make money? I thought long and hard about how I could control my own destiny. I could design electronic circuits, and I could fix cars. Those were the two great loves I had grown up with. Either might offer a career. Could I exchange my suit for overalls and start fixing automobiles instead of supervising engineers? I had always loved cars. I had continued to buy old cars, tinker with them, drive them, and sell them as long as I'd been on my own. I began to seriously consider the idea of abandoning electronics to become a mechanic or car dealer. I broached the subject to some of my friends and colleagues at work. I just can't do this anymore. I can't stand the bullshit, being in a company like this. It's just no fun anymore. They either didn't believe me or thought I was just depressed. You're going to quit electronics to become a car mechanic? You've got one of the top jobs in the company. Don't you know how many people would give their right arm for a job like yours? Or they would say, "You're full of shit. You can be straight with me. I'm your friend. If you've got a good job at a competitor, tell me. Maybe I can go too." Everyone thought there was some angle, some trick. But there wasn't. If you leave the industry, it's going to be very hard to get a job again in a few years. Look at Tom. Tom was one of our technicians. He had been an engineer until he quit work in order to build houses with his brother-in-law. When he wanted to return to engineering, the only job he could find was as a technician, a big step down from where he had been. But my mind was made up. I got into this business because I wanted to be creative. I wanted to design things. Now I'm just an administrator. Everyone I talked to at work seemed to think I was nuts. But in the end, it didn't matter what other people thought about my job. What mattered was what I thought about my job. And I didn't like it. It was time to take my chances on my own. In 1989, I quit my job and became a car dealer. That meant taking out a second mortgage against my house. That $30,000 was my seed money, and it was all I had, so it would have to last. I started to buy second-hand European cars, fix them up, and sell them. In addition, I serviced what I sold. My first acquisition was a 5-year-old Mercedes 300 SD, which I cleaned up, serviced, and sold for a profit of $1,500. It seemed I was off to a great start. I knew fixing up cars and selling them was not creative like designing sound effects, but it had much to recommend it. There was no long commute to work. I could be myself. I would no longer live in fear for my job. There would be no one to fire me. I would no longer feel like a fraud. Selling cars and doing car repairs would be whatever I could make of it. No one would question my qualifications or ability. If only it were that simple. By the time I realized there was more to it, the $30,000 was lost, and I was an additional $50,000 in debt. Somehow, the $1,500 profit I'd made on each of my first cars had turned into $2,000 and $3,000 losses on later ones, as the economy slid into recession and I made bad decisions. But there was no turning back. I had to succeed. I still remembered mixing my 30-cent macaroni dinner with water because I couldn't afford milk, and I had vowed never to return to that state. The thing that saved me was my technical skill, fueled by my Aspergian need to know all about topics that grabbed my attention. And cars certainly had my attention. I may not have made money selling them, but I had the knowledge to fix them when no one else could, and people paid me for that. Even more, their praise made me feel good about myself and gave me the courage to go on in the face of my financial losses. and the electrical problems that had other mechanics scratching their heads proved trivially simple for me. For 10 years, I had listened to my bosses tell me that I could not communicate or work with other people. Now the stakes were higher, and I seemed to be communicating successfully. How could I tell? Because people were coming back, and some of them were even visiting with me while work was done. I had found a niche where many of my Aspergian traits actually benefited me. My compulsion to know everything about cars made me a great service person. My precise speech gave me the ability to explain complex problems in simple terms. My directness meant that I told people what they needed to hear about their cars, which was good most of the time. And my inability to read body language or appearance meant, in an industry rife with discrimination, that I treated everyone the same. I lost money at first because I had to learn the business, which was to some extent a lesson in humility. Before going into the business of fixing cars, I had always looked at car repair as fundamentally simpler than, say, engineering. Having now done both, I know that isn't true. If anything, running an automotive repair business is harder for me because it uses a different kind of brain power, a kind that I had never developed during my engineering days. I had to acquire a broad range of new skills, and fast. Chief among them was the ability to deal with people in a friendly way that would make them want to return. In the past, I had not done very well with that, but circumstances were different now. Perhaps in my new setting, I could learn to succeed in dealing with people and leaving them feeling happy, or at least reasonably satisfied. My choice of car made a difference, as it turned out. I chose to work on high-end cars like Rolls-Royces and Land Rovers, because I loved the way they were put together. I appreciated the way a Rolls-Royce interior was made, like a piece of fine furniture. Each Rolls-Royce is a unique work of art, something a machine aficionado like me can really appreciate. And I loved the rugged simplicity of the Land Rover Defenders. From the first time I saw a Land Rover in the pages of National Geographic, I had been drawn to them. One day, I told myself, I will own one of my own. The cars I worked on tended to belong to affluent and better educated people. Such people were better able to connect with an eccentric Aspergian like me, and they had an incentive to do so. There were not many people willing to fix a Rolls-Royce or a Land Rover in my area. In many cases, the only service alternatives were in Boston or Hartford, an hour's drive away. So an owner of one of those cars had an incentive to make a relationship with me work, whereas a Chevrolet or Toyota owner had service alternatives everywhere he turned. At first, I did everything: repairs, billing, scheduling, and planning. As the business grew over its first few years, I added a technician to work on cars with me, then another, and another. After almost 20 years in business, Robeson Service now employs a dozen people. When I worked as an administrator for a big company, I was in the position of bending my staff to the whims of my employer. Yet I often felt my employer's desires and wishes were ill-conceived or just plain wrong, which made it very hard for me to feel good about imposing those wishes on others. As an owner, I imposed only my own wishes on my staff, and I only did what I believed in. I felt a lot better about that. Before opening my business, I had only interacted with a few people at one time: other engineers, people from marketing, family, and a small circle of friends. They were almost all people who knew me or knew of me. All of a sudden, my new line of work put me in front of the general public. Anyone with a car and a problem might call, and I had to talk to them. I had never been exposed to such a variety of humanity. This was beneficial to me in a number of ways. First, my ability to interact with people improved tremendously over the first few years I was in business. People who watched me during that time noticed a change. My friends remarked on how polite and nice I had become. I also learned a lot about how to succeed in life from the people who patronized my business. My clients taught me about real estate management, banking, investing, and general business principles. That education has been priceless, and I could never have gotten it from any school. For the next 15 years, I built myself a world of machines, a world in which I was securely positioned in the center. We worked on better and better cars, and we solved tougher and tougher problems. We became the repair shop of last resort, the place people went when no one else could figure it out. My Aspergian understanding of machines made our company unique in the auto service world. People began shipping Rolls-Royce, Land Rover, and Mercedes cars hundreds and even thousands of miles to our service department. I had finally made myself a place where I could feel safe and secure. And then I got a call. I was driving back from lunch when my phone rang.
"Hello, Mr. Robeson? This is Terry at Chicopee Savings Bank. Can you hold a minute for Mr. Wagner?"
Bill Wagner is the president of the bank I do business with. I pondered what might be wrong for 10 long seconds. Then Bill came on the line.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"Nothing," Bill said.
"John," he said, "I was hoping you would be willing to join the board of corporators at the bank."
I was stunned.
"Me? On the board of a bank?"
"I would be honored," was all I could think to say. And I realized that for the first time, I had become legitimate. A part of the local community, and not just an outcast. Chapter 23. I Get a Bear Cub. In the spring of 1990, in the midst of starting my company and losing all my money, I acquired a son. His mother was Little Bear, so of course I called him Bear Cub. Cubby, for short. The name on his birth certificate was Jack, in honor of my grandfather, and his mom used that name. But for me, he's always been Cubby, right to this day. Although I was excited and looking forward to his arrival, Cubby came along during a stressful time in my life. After living together for a few years, Little Bear and I had gotten married in 1982. But things started going bad between us 4 years later, after her older brother Paul died in a car crash. I was hoping things would improve with Cubby's arrival. In the months before he was born, I was anxious. Little Bear was sick all the time while she was pregnant, and I was afraid Cubby would be born sick too. I was also afraid he'd be born with 2 heads or 3 arms. He was born in the hatchery at the Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton. I drove Little Bear to the hospital on the evening of April 11th in an old gray Jaguar. We parked and checked in at 11:45, and he was born at 12:15. I was in the delivery room for the event. I had read a number of books on the topic, and I pretty much knew what to expect. Everything seemed normal. I was surprised at how little he was, though. I'd been timing him since we learned of his mom's pregnancy 8 months back. According to what the doctors had told us, Cubby was hatching a week early. I'd done a lot of reading, and I knew hatchlings put on quite a bit of weight in the 3 weeks before being born. So I was expecting him to come out somewhat small, but he was even littler than I expected. He weighed only 6 pounds and 6/10 of an ounce. "He's little, but he'll be fine," the doctor said. "No need for the incubator for him." Of course, they had no idea if he would be fine. They were just saying that to reassure us. They had not done any tests. They had, at that moment, done nothing more than a cursory external inspection. But I had studied the infant mortality statistics, and I knew this hospital gave us better than average odds. If all went well, we wouldn't be there long. One night in the hatchery, and they'd be sending Mom and Cubby home. That first day, I discreetly measured him on my forearm and noted his size and appearance. He didn't really do anything at that point, but I looked at him closely to try to remember what he looked like so I could tell if I had the right kid the next time I saw him. I was afraid I'd fail to recognize him the next day, which would be both embarrassing and humiliating. His mom was pretty excited, and so were our parents.
I made sure he was tagged with a nylon serial number plate on a ring around his leg before I allowed him to be released into the general population of hatchlings. They had a big room where all the babies lay behind glass and grew under heat lamps, just like the baby chick display at the state fair. Some were in incubators, but most were just on trays. I was glad he was tagged, because despite what they say about moms knowing their kids, you could not tell the one-day-old babies apart except in the most general way, like whether you had a boy or a girl. And I suppose if yours had an extra arm or missed a leg, he'd be recognizable. But most of the babies in there looked whole and virtually identical. The next morning, my parents came to see him, separately, since they had been divorced for many years, and my father had remarried. My mother came in first, followed by my father and stepmother. Little Bear's father and stepmother came too. Her mother and second husband lived in Florida, and they weren't there. But they called. We had a regular parade of visitors that first day.
"Ooh, just look at him. He's so sweet. Hey there, baby boy."
This with a jab in his belly.
"Ooh, he looks just like you."
Standard baby drivel, I figured, especially the part about how much he looked like me. How could a 6-pound baby with misshapen features and a head the size of an apple look just like me? I was glad I'd noted the numbers stamped on the bracelet. I didn't really think someone would intentionally swap him for another child, but mistakes do happen. I had also tagged him with a waterproof felt-tipped marker in case the bracelet went missing. That second day, my recognition fears from the previous night proved to be unfounded. When I arrived, Cubby and Mom were together in her bed. And just to be sure, I checked his tags and marks. They matched. After going home that day, Cubby never returned to any hospital overnight. So, as a result of my initial marking and caution, I have a very high level of confidence that the baby that emerged from his mother 17 years ago is the same kid living in my house today. We brought him home that second afternoon. I had bought a basket that doubled as a car seat to transport him. Little Bear wrapped him up and strapped him in. She carried the baby basket in her lap as they rolled her out of the hospital in a wheelchair. As we were leaving, I realized the hospital hadn't given us very much for the $4,400 hatchery fee. No accessories. No clothes. No toys. Just the kid. I never did figure out why they insisted on rolling Little Bear out the door in a wheelchair. After all, she came in on her own 2 feet, walking and talking. She wasn't sick, and she was 20 pounds lighter. Their insistence on rolling her out made me think of an auto repair shop where the cars drive in under their own power and get towed home on wreckers a few days later. Sort of backward. Cubby was so small, he could stretch nose to tail and not reach the length of my forearm. When we got him home, we lined a small laundry hamper with soft fabric and nestled him inside. Within a few weeks, he'd outgrown the little hamper. We moved him into one of Little Bear's big hampers, where he lived for most of the next year. When he was 3 days old, I took him to work and carried him around the neighborhood to show him off. Everyone praised and admired him. He didn't say much, but I'm sure he was taking it all in. We continued to carry him around wherever we went, thinking he would be better socialized the more he was around people. I had not yet learned about Asperger's when Cubby was born, but I knew I had a hard time with people, and I wanted Cubby to get along better than I had. I thought long and hard about how to accomplish that, and one of my ideas was to show him as many interesting people as I could. He was easy to carry around when he was small, and he looked closely at everyone and everything. I'd zip my windbreaker halfway and drop him in the opening. With his little arms sticking out and the zipper holding tight, he was securely wedged in place. But just to be sure, I always tied the string at the base of my windbreaker so he couldn't fall out the bottom. I often saw people staring at Cubby, zipped up like that, but they seldom said anything. "This is Cubby," I would say, while pointing at my jacket, from which he gazed serenely. I was very proud of him. I couldn't wait for him to get bigger and do more tricks. I even daydreamed of a time when he could actually be put to work, mowing the lawn and washing the car. Sadly, that day never came. He was destined to get bigger, but it proved extremely difficult, virtually impossible, in fact, to get useful work out of him. But I'm getting ahead of myself. When Cubby was little, I tried to show him all the things grown-ups did. When I worked on a car, I took him out with me and set him in the shade under the hood. He never said much in those early days, so I don't know what he made of it all. In the beginning, he wasn't very interesting because he didn't do anything. But then he began to yell. I took him out of the hamper and let him sleep on my chest. I had read that hearing a parent's heartbeat calmed a baby. If he continued to yell, I held him tightly against me. I had a mantra for him. Calm and docile animal. Calm and docile animal. Calm and docile animal. Calm and docile animal. Eventually, if I squashed him hard enough and murmured to him long enough, he would stop struggling and go to sleep. I liked it when he slept on my chest, except when he drooled, peed, or threw up on me. But I always worried about him, too. I was afraid I'd roll over and suffocate him, but I guess parents have instincts about those things. And I never did. When he got bigger, he started to crawl. Cubby's laundry hamper proved its worth, as I turned it over to form a storage enclosure within which he could crawl to his heart's content. He grew fast, and in no time at all, he could upend the hamper. At that point, we got a crib. Then he started talking. He would come up to me and say, "Baby toss, baby toss," until he got my attention. He stuck his arms up, too, to make sure I understood. I would pick him up and toss him in the air and catch him time and time and time again. He never tired of baby toss. He had the most remarkable confidence in my ability to catch him. If I were him, I'd never have done baby toss. I'd have been afraid the tosser would miss and I'd go splat on the floor. We began reading books together. He loved Dr. Seuss. I read those books so often I could turn the pages and say the words from memory. I became bored with repetition, and I began to make subtle alterations. The story turned into one fish, two fish, black fish, blue fish, I eat you fish, and see them all, see them run, the man in back, he has a gun. I liked my improvisations. They broke up the monotony of reading the same thing time and time again. But despite the smoothness with which I worked these modifications into the good doctor's stories, Cubby would notice. He would get mad. "Read it right, Dad," he would yell. Eventually, I started making up stories. That worked better because he didn't have a routine to expect, but it was harder because I had to make the stories up as fast as I could recite them. His favorites were about Gorko, Udu, and Wudu. They were flying lizards, and they had lived in flying lizard land, but now they were here. I wove his children's books into the Gorko stories, and he liked that. He especially loved hearing how Thomas the Tank Engine, his favorite train, was picked up and carried off to flying lizard land by the cargo lizards, big lizards with nets. We spent many enjoyable hours riding around, looking out the windows of our cars at distant flying lizards drifting on the breezes. I also told him stories of where he came from. It seems like all kids wonder that. I told him about the kid store and how he was on a tray stuck in the window when we picked him out. He felt proud when I told him he had been the most expensive kid in the store, the top model. Later on, when he went to school, he heard alternate explanations for where he came from. But he was happy and content until then. We built stuff together, too. Cubby loved Legos, but he always insisted on building the kits exactly as they told you in the instructions. Little Bear encouraged that. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to modify them. Cubby especially disliked my attempts to fit two heads or three arms to the Lego action figures.
"Build 'em right, Dad,"
he squawked indignantly at my two-headed spaceman. I worked a lot while Cubby was small, and I left many of the kid management decisions up to Little Bear. She stayed home with him, and she deserves all the credit for his basic training. It was probably better that way. I'm not all that well-trained myself, so I'm not always the best of role models. But when he became fully self-propelled, I started taking him on expeditions, and I felt good at that. Sunday was our special day. Every Sunday, he would wake up and say, "Adventure Day, Dad!" I took him to all the places little boys love. Train yards, junkyards, shipyards, airports, museums, restaurants and bars. Many weekends we went to the Conrail Yard in West Springfield to watch the trains.